Oh, you guys stopped at, have you just been waiting for me?
No, we've actually been talking the whole time. We only got to, sell swords and hedgehogs.
Oh my God. We've been on this thing for like an hour and 40 minutes.
I know.
Y'all are crazy.
Monster.
Spoiler alert. This podcast will cover events in the most recent aired episode of Game of Thrones on HBO. If you have not seen that episode yet, you may wish to avoid this podcast until you have. Otherwise, we hope you enjoy.
Dedicated to HBO's Game of Thrones and George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire book series, you're listening to Podcast Winterfell. Now, here's your host, Matt Murdock.
Hey, it's episode 227 of the podcast, an NBR special for the folks who have gotten the season 4 box sets, either DVDs or Blu-rays, and we'll talk about both and the differences and what have you. My name is Matt Murdock. I'm from podcastwinterfell.com. That's where you can find all of the back episodes of the podcast. You can find, links to how to contact me. You can find all the social media, and you can find the links to those podcatchers where you can leave me a review, and I will be happy to thank you on our Wednesday podcast during the spoiler-free news section, because I need them. I always need reviews. There's never enough reviews. I got a bunch for the DVD giveaway, which we want to, again, congratulate Greg. Kills was his name on iTunes. He's from the Canadian store, and he won a set, and he got back to me letting me know that he got them, and that's great. And to talk about all of this stuff, we're going to be getting into some deep stuff about not just the Blu-rays, but we're also going to talk about the A Day in a Life special that came out on HBO a few weeks ago as well, in a little more detail than Bubba and I did before. And I think we talked about that in the NBR section, or the BR section for the most part. So this might all be new for you, NBRs. Non-book readers, of course, is what I'm calling you. Nonetheless, here we go. We're going to introduce two fabulous guests. They're a regular part of the Initial Reactions podcast, and one of them is the host. He's also the guy that does all of my voiceovers for Podcast Winterfell. We welcome back on Twitter at W Axel Foley, Mr. Axel Foley.
Hello, Matt. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm so excited to be talking about the Game of Thrones
Friends version. Great, man. It's great to have you back. And, of course, another regular who has joined me on a couple of casts this year as well, and that would be the fabulous host of the Film List podcast. You can find him on Twitter at Heath Actor. We welcome back. He goes by Heath Snow here. Welcome back, Heath.
Daragalis, Dracarys, I love you both.
Aw, a little love never hurts. First of all, before we get into talking about them specifically, Heath, let me ask you real quick. How does this set compare to other sets of the prior seasons? Were you just as excited about getting this one, or is it kind of like you knew what to expect, or were you surprised by anything?
Yeah, I mean, I was watching the extras. It was kind of a lot of... It almost felt like they were for people who don't podcast or read the books.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved the round table was my favorite thing that we'll get to. That was awesome. But, you know, I'm excited. I'm going to rewatch the season, and it's Game of Thrones, baby.
Game of Thrones, and we're all killing time until we get to April 12th. And, Axel, I know you've looked over the histories and lore section, and were you surprised by any of the things, people who voiced over or anything like that?
No, not really. I thought it was great. It didn't blow me away. Maybe there's certain things, that, I'm more interested in learning about, or maybe the newness of the original one, since I am an NBR, I don't know any of that stuff, you know? So I have, I kind of knew some of this stuff and I was surprised that I knew it. But I mean, I enjoy it and they all, I don't own, the box set. I've seen it and I've read reviews and stuff like that. And I'm interested in talking about it. But I mean, they're, you know, the fact that they even do that is pretty cool in my eyes.
Right on. Well, as you know, a lot of guys put out on YouTube and things like that, podcasts, the unboxing of their sets after they get them, usually the day after. And I saw a few of those. People get really excited about that, about what covers they get and all of that kind of thing. And I guess the first section to really start to dive in is our unboxing. And, Heath, let's talk to you first. Which cover did you get? And then I'll list them all after that.
I got the House Martell cover, Matthew.
All right. And that was available from Best Buy. That's a great cover. That's a great cover. And I just got the standard. I went through Amazon. I got the standard three-eyed raven cover, which really looks good. Don't get me wrong. But there are several other lists here, like the standard cover that I mentioned, House Martell that you mentioned, Heath. I know that Baba told me that he got his House Tyrell cover, which is a special one with the symbol of the golden rose on there. And then, there's also the standard three that Best Buy is also normally put out, which is the Targaryen, Lannister, and Stark. I believe they've done that every single year, but they're all in limited edition. So, sometimes if you don't get to Best Buy that day, you don't get the special ones and you end up with the standard one like me. Ha. Axel, if you had your druthers, which one would you pick?
You know, I'm not sure what they're called because I just know the pictures. And I'm not so good at the, at knowing what the symbols are. Already I'm into this podcast. I feel like I'm an idiot, but here we go. I'm diving in because that's what I do. My favorite one is, I think, it is, it's the one with the, spear, like the,
yeah.
And the orange background. Who is that?
That would be Heath's, the Martell cover.
Yeah, there you go. I think that's the coolest one. I like the other ones. The dragon was cool and the, what is that? Like an octopus coming up. So I guess I can figure out what they are.
Oh, the Kraken. That would be a great
Kraken.
One.
There you go. Yeah. But to me, I like the colors of it and I like the way it's drawn. It's really earthy, you know, and it kind of it just doesn't, you know, Game of Thrones, when you think about it, is so dark all the time. Mm-hmm. And, with very clean lines. And this looks very, indigenous, you know, folky to me. So that the fact that it's different makes it cool to me. And perchance I was to purchase this would be the one I would look for.
Right on. Man, that's great. And there were differences between the different sets, that you got, like say between buying at Target or buying at Best Buy or buying through Amazon. Some of the sets included bonus discs, and including there was a difference between the Blu-rays and the DVDs, as there always is, because Blu-rays you can fit more information on, obviously. The Blu-rays had, included with them the histories and lore extras. And, also the interactive guide. As you watch each episode, you can, call up locations, you can call up character information, you can call up, history information. A lot of that pulls from the same history and lore section, actually, but a little synopsis to help you get back into who is who and why is why and where is where is always helpful. Now the difference between the Blu-rays and the DVDs stopped there, except, again, if you purchased, your DVDs I don't know if it was the DVDs or not, but I know your Blu-rays, you definitely got a bonus disc, from Best Buy. And I know that Heath, since he bought his at Best Buy, has that. It was called a special disc called Shock and Awe, The Visual Effects of Season 4. Now, Heath, I don't have a Best Buy copy. So, if you can give us any content of that.
Oh, yes, I will. I actually took notes. I'm sorry. I've been watching a lot of SNL, and I'm the Sean Connery crap. All right, sorry. I'll stop. So the shock and awe was actually really good. It basically broke down how they CGI everything, what they shoot against green screen, and the amount of work that goes into creating a shot-for-shot Game of Thrones episode. They went over the melting down of Ned Stark's sword and saw some behind the scenes with that. The best one was the Joffrey death close-up. Spoiler alert. Well, everyone's watched the season. But how they had to add the blood and his eyes moving, it was really interesting. And they have some great interviews with Jack Gleason about that. The Oberyn death's great. They basically go how they use the prosthetic, his real face, and how they overlapped it so it could create the whole killing of Oberyn when the mountain smashes his head. A lot of CGI with Marine. I loved it because they have the Unsullied. They have 300 extras, and they CGI 8,000. So it's pretty interesting. It goes into the dragons and Braavos, amongst other things. But if you're a special effects guru, or you just want to see how an episode's made, this bonus disc is excellent for that, and I actually really enjoyed it.
Great, man. I wish I had a copy of that. I know that some teasers for it have been put out on YouTube if you want to catch, like, maybe the first minute of the episode. I haven't seen that the official Game of Thrones has released it yet out like they have some other things that they've put out on their official YouTube. So we can hope that maybe somewhere down the line we'll all have access to it. But in the meantime, you special Best Buy viewers or buyers get that great special. There was also another special that was offered through Target, which is called Silk Leather and Chainmail, and that's about the costumes of Game of Thrones, with, of course, costume creator Michelle Clapton and various actors and directors talking about the costumes. That is available online, and I will put it's an extra that they put up on Vimeo, or that someone put up on Vimeo. So I will put that link in the show notes if you all want to see it, if you haven't. I have also tweeted it out, that link, on February 23rd, if you want to go back through at Winterfell Pod on Twitter and look back to February 23rd. I don't tweet that much, so it shouldn't be that hard to find. Let me ask you, Axel, if you had your druthers, would you rather see the special effects special or the costume special?
I'd be going to Best Buy.
All right, there it is.
Two for two.
I actually rather enjoyed the costume one. I thought that it was kind of fun to see how that brings those actors into the world of Game of Thrones a little more.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, I would like it. I would not like to see that, but I guess I'm a little bit more interested in that, in the effects and stuff like that, you know, that visual aspect. But the costumes are a huge part of this show, and they're amazing.
They are. They are. And there's an aspect that you guys share, the two of you share, that I have no idea about. You know, these kind of specials are really informative to me because I have no idea of how the sausage is made, so to speak, of the filmmaking. And you guys are both in the film industry or in the media industry. And so I'm sure you guys can, like, take notes and say, well, I would have done this or I would have done that. Or you can say, well, that's a great idea. I might use that in my next project or what have you. So,
well, I think that the greatest lesson to learn from that is everything they do is the toppest of the top notch. So anyone watching, if you were watching behind the scenes or if you knew about what happens on huge, like $200 million, $300 million films, that's what they're doing on Game of Thrones.
Wow.
It's that there's no, you know, it's just like we had talked a little bit about that A Day in the Life special that came out. Mm-hmm. And you see there, I mean, they don't cut corners. They're like renting out historic buildings, you know what I mean? Like being the first people ever to do it and shoot it there. It's absolutely, you know, the top of the top as far as quality of filmmaking goes. They're making movies. There's nothing TV about the way they make this show.
It is on a whole different scale from just about any other television show.
Worldwide. And that's worldwide. That's not like, you know, well, in China, they can do this and this. No, they're doing like the best in the world. I'm sure there's some films that were nominated for Best Picture would have liked some of their budget.
Yeah, I know, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and they shoot with two units all the time. Sometimes they add a third unit when they're shooting as well. So you have the wolf unit and the dragon unit that are constantly shooting during the filming of Game of Thrones, usually in two different locations in two different places around the world, as that A Day in the Life put. And then I think at one point they had to break into a third unit during the filming for season 5. So that is just so much to coordinate. I just can't imagine how much it takes to keep from pulling your hair out at the end of every day of production.
Yeah, and that goes that's from the bottom to the top, you know, whether it's clothing or weapons, locations, types of cameras that they're using, ways that they're editing or delivering it to the editors. Everything they do is like, you know, and they're in many ways, I think, breaking new ground in helping other people learn how to do this as they become more efficient at it. And that's one of the cool things that you can see over the course of the seasons and these special features, that they learn how, you know, now in this season, like, new people come in and they go new places, but they continue to do it at such a high level and with such high regard too, you know? They all take it seriously and they know they're making something. I mean, this is a show for the ages. I know we all love it, but it's absolutely true. Trust me, they ain't making 2.5 men like this.
Hey, and I'll let me piggyback on Axel. It's funny because I'm watching this stuff from a different perspective. Because I've been on sets like this, and I know it's like, and they show clips of the producers talking, and I love it because you could see the stress in like Dan and Dave's, but also you're not seeing the arguments. The there's so much that goes on that it's actually good that they don't show because it may ruin things for fans. But there's a lot of stress involved, and I was just waiting for there to be a little outtake of damn you, what do you know, but there's so much more, and I'm looking in the background, I'm looking at the grips carrying stuff, and I'm like, oh boy, like there's that one where they literally have to, the line producer says you walk up and you walk down and you don't walk up and walk down empty handed or you'll get yelled at, and I'm like, yeah, that's makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there is stress. The other thing, the other benefit of the fact that they go through this and everything, and even to the point of the actors themselves, is that now at the end of season 4, it seems like the actors themselves know their characters a lot better, which I think benefited the first feature of the Blu-ray, and DVDs entitled The Politics of Power. Which really essentially was just a recap of season 3, but you could feel like Kit Harington and Emilia Clarke, when they were discussing their characters and what was happening to them, that they had a much deeper understanding of what their characters were than if this feature had been produced, say, at the end of season 1 for that particular Blu-ray. So that's the first kind of bonus that you get on the disc 1 of your Blu-rays or DVDs. It's 25 minutes long. I don't know if anybody has any comments about that particular thing. To me, this particular feature, even though it was interesting to a degree, someone who lives in the world of Game of Thrones like year round, I didn't really need a recap. How about you, Heath?
Yeah, I was the same way. Excuse me, sorry. I was the same way, Matt. It just It was okay. I'm like, okay. I was just kind of getting through it. It was cool, but I had just watched season 3 not too long ago. So it was just, you know, I was a little bored, but yet I understand why they put it on there, because for those who don't live in the Game of Thrones world year-round, it's a good catch-up. So I'm sure it benefits a lot of viewers who aren't, like, obsessed like us.
If I was looking at this and I just bought the box set, this is probably one that I'd skip. Because it seems, you know what I think sometimes, and this is interesting, is when you watch special features, whether it's for something like this that's so grand and they have so much to choose from, right? Or like a film where sometimes they might just do like, you know, the car. How did we build the car, you know? Sometimes you can tell that some of the special features, like somebody actually got an idea where they hired, you know, someone to produce this, and they went out and, you know, hired someone to go and actually through the season shoot bits that could make into the special feature. Like there was forethought in it. And other special features, especially like that, when I see 25 minutes, it makes me think that this is a worldwide promotional piece. That some of the special features are actually marketing pieces that are made and then inserted into the Blu-ray or DVD as an extra, mm-hmm. when that may have played on like the BBC or, you know, maybe in like,
Hungary,
Indonesia or something, you know what I mean? To like get people into the next season.
Yeah.
Or maybe even something that HBO at some point would have available on HBO Go. So when I see that, and when I was reading when the Blu-rays came out, I was reading like what the special features were, that seemed to me right away something that I'd probably skip. But then again, for people who aren't like us, and I still hear it, and I don't know if you guys hear it, but I still hear it on podcasts with like critics that I respect, where they're like, yeah, I still can't tell one bearded white guy from the other. And, you know, that ended for me on like episode 4 or 5. And then maybe when I had to pick up again in season 2, I had to refresh myself. But that is a real thing. So I think it has to be respected, and having something that is just basically kind of like a primer for people before they watch the season for actual shows, it's good to have something like this.
Yeah, because it's funny. Remember the miniseries Band of Brothers? When I first watched it, I couldn't follow who was who. And then the actors got bigger and I got familiar with them. And when I rewatched it, I'm like, oh, I was able to follow it. I had trouble in season 2, and then once I rewatched it and learned the actors, now I know who Ian Glenn is and everyone. So it's like much easier now for me to pick out. But if you're not familiar with the actors, it can be tough when you have so many characters.
Yeah, I agree. There is a feature on here, which we'll talk about in a minute, called The New Characters and Locations. That is also on disc 1 of the Blu-rays and the DVDs. But before that, the next line down is The Bastards of Westeros. And this is the one feature that features the author of the source material and, of course, the showrunners. And they basically tell you what it means to be a bastard in Westeros. Heath, let me start with you. Did you find the fact that the origin of your name, Snow, was brought to light a little more, and how you're treated? Should we treat you more like the Bastards of Westeros, or should we just treat you with a little more respect than they get?
Well, Trebek, you should treat me like a bastard. you know, it's funny. When I was watching this, I really enjoyed the Bastards of Westeros. I really liked it. I was like, ooh, it's over. And I'm like, wait a minute, I know all this information. And I'm like, have I seen this before? I'm like, no, I've been on Podcast Winterfell, baby. And you guys taught me about the locations of what a name is to be a bastard, and how in Dorne they're celebrated and they're not looked down upon. So I was like, did I watch it? I'm like, no, Matt, Bubba, and everybody taught me the information. So, yes, I like that, though. That's a great from the mind of George to, you know, where you're a bastard and kind of the sections of where you were born. I kind of like that there's different names. But I loved how, you know, basically you have some royal blood, but you're a bastard. And if you're just a bastard with no royalty, you're really low. And I really liked this special feature. It was very interesting.
I found it somewhat interesting. Again, like you said, it was information that I kind of already knew, and it feels a little repetitive to a certain history and lore feature that's about the Bastards of Westeros as well. But I did appreciate it. I always like to see George on screen. I always hope that he'll laugh because he reminds me of Beavis when he laughs. But nonetheless, I didn't get that. Let me ask you, Axel, really quickly. We'll go over the bastard names in the history and lore section as well. But if you could choose between being from the north, say being a snow, or being from the extreme south, being a sand, which bastard would you choose?
You know, it's tough because, as Heath knows, I have a thing for the snow. I'm kind of a cold guy. I like the cold. But of course I'd like to be treated better, you know? So what I would do is I would, just travel between on my magical unicorn. That's probably what I'd do.
You'd just do a little finger and teleport to wherever. That's what
I do. Exactly. Exactly. It takes everybody else, you know, the whole season to walk 4 miles, but I will teleport within the space of one break of action to another place. But I don't know, you know, I'm a Winterfell guy, man. You know what I'm saying? I gotta say. And plus, I gotta be with the bastard Heath Snow. So I guess I'll have to be the bastard Axel Snow.
Right. Well, we'll put you both on the wall, and you all have some fun defending from the White Walkers.
Yeah, we can pee off the wall podcast.
Yeah,
wow,
exactly.
We can do
this. No, seriously, they should have. We should make like a special, Heath. You got to. We'll both travel to Alaska, and we'll make a little short film where we're like two guys that are just like hiding at the end of the wall. Just being like, what is going on with these people? The Starks and the Lannisters and all that. Come on.
Oh, let's do it.
Excellent. All right. Well, Axel, you brought up the getting to know new characters and everything. And that was that was another feature in this. And they did have George R. R. Martin in this a little bit. They had Dave and Dan, of course, and the various actors who were discussing the new Westeros or Essos locations, as well as the new characters in season 4. I don't think this is going to be any shock to anybody, because I think we're all going to come up with the same answer. But who was your favorite new character in Game of Thrones season 4, Axel?
My favorite new character in season 4. Of course I'm going to say, my man, the Viper. But I was trying to think of if there's some obscure person, that was introduced that would be interesting to talk about. But, that's my man.
Yeah. Oberyn, I think, is just going to be everybody's man, certainly mine. How about you, Heath, and what did you think of the obviously you'd just seen season 4 a little while ago, but did you find any interest in the new characters or locations they were describing? Maybe more about the locations and what they mean. I don't know. Would any impressions of that special, sir?
Yeah, it was a good buffer for me because we talk about the Dread Fort and different places, and while we were watching the season live, it was a little like, okay, but now it kind of reinforced everything, so I was like, okay, I remember these locations now, and I know what they're called. I love seeing Braavos. That's like, I would love to chill out in Braavos for a couple of years, and of course, Prince Oberyn, the Red Viper, he'll be my favorite, and always will be. I just wish he was still in the damn show. But, hey, what are you going to do? I liked this section, and it was cool to kind of get, oh, okay, that was new. That's right, that was new. We hadn't seen that before. So it was a good little good little 7.5 minute special feature that I enjoyed.
Exactly, exactly. And that's it for what you get on disc one, essentially in terms of the extras. And then you have to move to disc 4 of the Blu-rays or disc 5 of the DVDs, to get to more of these, specials. So we'll start with the documentary on the making of the Battle of the Wall, which of course features Neil Marshall, Dave and Dan, various actors and producers. And, again, this is kind of one of those how the sausage is made kind of, documentaries. And I always find that fascinating myself. Heath, did you come away with any impressions of that particular one?
Yeah, this one actually, it had me watching the whole thing. I love Neil Marshall, the director. It was good to see him, chat about the episode. And of course he's got the same birthday as me, May 25th. Send all presents to thefilmless@gmail.com. But I got a new appreciation for that episode. I remember when I first watched, I was like, it was visually great, but I was like a little down on it. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, ooh, I like this episode. And now after seeing what went into it, I'm like, I'm in. It's too bad that we watch an episode and be like, it's not that great. But then you see how it's made, and I'm like, it's freaking amazing. I mean, how they built the wall set, the fire barrels with the stunt guys, and how they, you know, set them on fire and with the CGI and everything, and really gave me a new appreciation for this episode. And it just, what I really, you know, the CGI with the mammoth and the giant, it was just really amazing how these creative minds come together and create this stuff. I mean, they're geniuses. But I loved how they build the set of the wall. That was phenomenal. And I wanted to go and play on this set. Like, as an actor, like, you know, you do a lot of indie films or low-budget TV shows. You know, they're fun to do. But when you are on a big set and you get to, like, put the costume on and go on an actual set, it just brings out more. So I can imagine Kit Harington and everyone working on the wall and doing this episode. You just really get into it as an actor with what's around you. And it's just, it's an amazing feeling. And I got chills watching it get put together.
I did too. And I'll turn to you in a second, Axel, but I just want to say that, you know, I was kind of a downer about episode 9 of when I first saw it on television. Once we got the episode 10 and 9 and 10 felt kind of like a two-part finale, my rating of episode 9, Watchers on the Wall, got better looking at it in retrospect. After watching this and seeing all the trouble that they went to make this particular episode and how beautifully it came together, and then seeing it in IMAX, in the theaters last month, I'm a big fan of this episode now. So, Axel, let me tell you, or ask you, just, and I know you haven't seen this particular special probably, but, has your opinion about episode 9 of last year changed any, looking at it back in retrospect?
No.
No. Were you always a fan?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, then there you go. That's all it is.
Yeah, no. I would watch it right now.
Right on.
I thought it was awesome. Did I say something different back in the day? Because I talk a lot.
No, I couldn't recall, actually, so I didn't know if you were one of the downers like me.
No. Actually, I think I was I really liked it. I didn't have huge expectations. The one that I was underwhelmed by was the initial, you know, big battle that took place. Oh God, man. See, I got to get back in Game of Thrones, like, vocabulary. You see, I'm going to stumble through this, and then by like episode 2, I'm going to be knowing everybody's middle name. The Battle of Blackwater.
Yes.
That to me was, and I think if you listen back at the podcast, that was a little underwhelming to me, but I loved this episode. Absolutely. I thought the pacing was great. You know, there's things here and there that could have been better, but I thought that the scale was good. I really loved it.
Yeah, and it was Neil Marshall's second stab at doing a big episode. And if you recall, during the season two, the filming of season two, Neil didn't have any time to prepare. I mean, he was literally hired, I think, 1 week before production started at that time. And this time he had time to kind of think things through. He was given the usual preparation time that directors there are given, whatever that is. So it was a much better experience for me as compared to the Battle of Blackwater as well. Why don't we move on to the next feature, which was on disc 5 of the DVDs or on disc 4 of the Blu-rays. And this one will be, of course, one that Heath will want to talk a lot about. It's called The Fallen, which is a roundtable. It's hosted by Brian Cogman, and it includes Sibelka Kelly, who, of course, plays Shay, Rose Leslie, who played Ygritte, Pedro Pascal, who played Oberyn Martell, Jack Gleason, who played, of course, King Joffrey, Charles Dance, who played Tywin, Thomas Brody Sangster, who played Jojen, and Mark Stanley, who played Grin, in a discussion about their kind of their characters' journeys and demises from a character and acting point of view. This is one of my favorite features on the whole disc. Brian Cogman hosts about like me. He stumbles around. He's not very good at leading people. So I had an appreciation for
that. That is not true.
I had an appreciation for his effort to really get the actors into talking about their characters and about how they felt on the day of shooting their last scenes and what have you. And I'll turn it over to Heath, because I think your opinion of the actress, well, maybe not her acting, but at least of the actress who played Shay changed, right?
Yes, this is the gem of the special features. This roundtable was frickin' amazing. I loved it. And yes, Sibel, who plays Shay, I fell in love with her. I'll admit it.
What?
Her smile, her persona. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I've hated your character for 4 seasons. She was awesome. And now I understand why they hired her. And she's just, I love her now. So, Shay, I love you. Okay. I got that out of the way. Pedro Pascal, the dude is just like, he's like the only actor I've ever been intimidated by that I've met or worked with, and I've worked with Stallone, Jamie Foxx, a bunch of people, is Benjamin Bratt. For some reason, Benjamin Bratt, I was like, dude, that's like a man. Pedro Pascal has that same aura about him, and I'm like, this dude's so cool, and he's funny, and he's just, I'm like, man, I want to be him for a day. Jack Gleason, oh my God, his... he makes like these bad jokes like that are so funny, and they call him out on it, and he's just really witty and he's hilarious, and I'm like, Joffrey, I love you. And what a difference. I mean, when you see him just talking and he plays this Joffrey guy who we hate, sorry Bubba, I know you love him, but it was just like awesome. Charles Dance, he was witty too, and he was giving Jack a little crap, like in a fun way. It was a pleasure to see them all kind of discuss. Even Gren's like, the guy who plays Gren, Mark Stanley's like, yeah, this was my first job. And I'm like, what? And I looked at his IMDb page, and I'm like, yes, it is his first job. I'm like, how? How did he get hired as his first job? So I was just like, I was thrown aback. The Jojen Reed guy, Thomas Brody Sangster, he was just like a little geek, but he was, you know, very warm, and he was pretty cool. And Rose Leslie was great, but I love how they the good thing is Pedro Pascal talked about how he shot his death scene and then shot other scenes after, so it wasn't like his last scene. And they go, yeah, and I left with Lena Headley, and it's like, oh, your BFF. They were giving them stuff, and I know, I guess they've dated, and they might have even had a kid together. I don't know. So that was interesting. And Pedro Pascal said that after his last shot, he jumped into the water, and all the crew that still had to work were like, oh, you bastard. So those are the highlights. There's a lot of other great stuff in there that the actors talk about. But this, like I said, this is the gem of the special features. And Axel, you need to watch it now.
this is definitely one that I wanted to see. This is the one that I think was drawn to, even more than the previous one we were talking about, because I think this is where you get into that heart of how much these people care about this show. And I had heard an interview with Pedro Pascal. I don't remember when. It was like on the radio or something, or maybe a podcast. And he just seemed like you're saying, like the coolest dude. And he had such a thoughtful approach to the show,
mm-hmm.
and to this role. And you can tell that through all the people that, you know, I mean, I think that everyone who's a part of this, and it comes through in this, and just listening to you all talk about it, everyone's who's a part of this show knows that it's something special, and they take it seriously, and they know that because of the fan base too, this might be their bread and butter the rest of their lives.
Oh yeah. Like even Pedro Pascal, who's worked ever since he's done Game of Thrones. Now his career has taken off. All these actors are going to be able to work based on being on Game of Thrones, and it just sets their whole life up. And it's freaking, I'm a little jealous, but at the same time, it's like, hey, you know what? God bless you, you know, and it's good for them because they put a lot of hard work into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one gem that I will say that I picked up on that I wasn't aware of was you said that Mark Grin's first job was, he started his first day was with John Bradley, who plays Samwell. And that was Samwell's first job as well, from what I understand.
Yes.
That was John Bradley's first job. And he does one of the voiceovers for the history and lore section, which is the next section on the Blu-rays. This is a total of 16 history and lores, which covers everything from houses to mythological stuff, to magical stuff, to practical stuff. It's a lot of information that really supplements season 4. And perhaps in some aspects, I won't say specifically what, but I think in perhaps it sets up some things for season 5 as well. That's kind of what they did with the season 3 history and lores as well. They kind of set up some things for season 4. It's nothing that will spoil you in that terms, but at least then when you watch season 5, you'll go, oh, I've heard that name before. Oh, that's where I heard that name before. And it'll help you give a better context of what you're seeing in season 5. If season 5 goes along the same, kind of skew from the source material that it has, in years prior. Can't guarantee that'll be the same next year, because as book readers know, we won't have Winds of Winter coming out in 2015. So, don't know if there will be as much history and lore for them to draw from as they had in this season. But we'll start out with the House Martell discussion. And, of course, this is Pedro Pascal voicing over the whole House Martell history and such. And some words that you might want to keep in mind, Axel. Unbowed, unbent, unbroken. Those are the house words, and I don't know if we'll hear those uttered anywhere or not, but just like the Starks' winter is coming and the Lannisters' is hear me roar, I know a lot of fans kind of get into that stuff. What was your impression, Axel, of this first view of House Martell, just overall? I mean, did you enjoy getting some information about how House Martell married into this Rhoynish princess that came from across the Narrow Sea, or was any of that of interest to you at all?
Yeah, sure. Of course it was. It was cool. And the thing that's – and the coolest thing is that he's doing it like in character. You know, so you can hear in his voice pride and loss and love, and you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I thought it's great. All this little stuff that you get fills in the world. Even if something is never, and that goes for all of these histories and lores, even if something is never mentioned in the show or it doesn't directly affect something that goes on, even if it's just a little piece of knowledge to have in your noggin. I really appreciate these because it fills in the world to us NBRs. And I don't know, one question I wanted to ask is, and I may, we may have already discussed this, was any of this stuff not in the books?
No, I think all of this stuff is scattered throughout the books. The interesting thing, you know, our friend Bubba from the Joffrey podcast, he likes during our book podcast to make all of us people who are reading the books for the first time or maybe only the second time, to do the math, so to speak. And what that is the fact that George places this kind of information, and he strings it throughout the books, but sometimes there's a piece of it here and a piece of it there, and you have to put it all together into these singular stories that Dave and Dan produce that are featured in the history and lore section. And like you said, what they do is they facilitate world building, which is a big feature of George's books. He spends time building a place, building a world, and you don't have time in a television show really to do that in the same way that George does in the books. And that's why I think that these kind of features are absolutely brilliant. Heath, I know that you're a limited book reader. What information in this particular history did you find new for you?
Like Axel said, it just kind of pieces it all together. I love the pre-stuff of, you know, what happened with House Martell and how they were, like, overtaken for, like, 2 months. And then in a fortnight, they got it back. And I just love the little pieces. And, again, for them to be in character doing it, it just brings you in. And I just love the information. Now, I unfortunately didn't get through most of these yet. I felt like I was cramming, and I'm like, oh, I want to enjoy this, so I didn't really have time to go through them all. But I watched a few. But it adds so much. It's almost like being a non-book reader, but yet you almost feel like, oh, okay, cool, I'm getting information that book readers have gotten, but it's like the Cliff Notes version, but they're really interesting, and you really, like, I want to learn more. Now I'm excited, to see Dorne and to see more people from the House Martell, and I just love how, you know, they don't have kings or queens, it's princes and princesses, and I just love how I just really got into the makeup of their society, so it was really interesting for me.
Absolutely. And to speak to Nymeria, who was the princess who came across from the Rhoyn, we've heard that name before. This is where Arya gets her name for her direwolf, is the source of this. So I love that kind of linkage between the Sands and House Stark, just in the way that both of them really hate the Lannisters. Another little interesting point, women are not treated as secondary citizens in Dorne. There are no kings, there are only princes. I'm not really sure if that means anything, though, because there still has to be a ruler. Another thing that's interesting, that is a call out to something in season 4, in the episode where Tywin comes to Oberyn to ask him to be a juror, is this whole thing about the defeating of Aegon the Conqueror. Now, we don't get exactly how they turned the Queen's dragon away, but I think this is why Tywin had a specific interest in Oberyn. There is some mention about dragons and such between the two of them, and I think Tywin was finally realizing that, hey, maybe dragons are a threat now. So I really appreciate that shout-out in there. And the shout out between, Martell and House Tyrell. I wonder if there's some friction there between those two houses, not just between the Martells and the Lannisters, but it's seemingly a Tyrell Stewart, was reigning there for King Darian, or was being the Stewart for King Darian. And, he was, got some scorpions placed on him, as a little trick instead of the consorts that he was hoping to get. And you get a little bit about Elia, who is, of course, Oberyn Martell's sister, who was married to the prince, that would be the Mad King's son, that was killed, that we hear Dany talk about a lot. Robert's rebellion started because this prince who had married Elia was the one who
captured Lyanna Stark and basically set Robert off on this whole rebellion thing. Actually, I guess it sent the Starks down to King's Landing, and they ended up being killed by the Mad King, which didn't help matters at all either. So there's a lot of things that are interconnected just between these Stark and Martell houses, which I really appreciated. Axel, anything else about this particular special, sir?
No, sir. But I love to hear that dude's voice, man.
Me too. Me too. Well, let's move on to the other house that is featured in the Blu-rays. And that is, of course, the history of House Baelish, which is, of course, voiced by Aidan Gillen. It's an interesting one as well. And we'll talk a little bit about it. Let me just rattle off some real quick bullet points about it that I came up with. You get, of course, the history of House Baelish. The family originally came from Braavos, another interesting kind of connection. And you get a little bit about this Ninepenny King's War, which for book readers, and I this is one of those features that is kind of new, I think, for most TV viewers. But they talk about a small group, that were perhaps, descendants or related to the, what's called the Blackfyre Rebellion, that Barristan Selmy helped to extinguish. So you get a little bit more history of why everybody thinks Barristan Selmy is this incredible knight. And evidently Littlefinger's father helped out with that as well. And that's what kind of gained him the status to end up being warded by Hoster Tully, and be with, Kat and Lysa. And I found all of that very interesting, is from Littlefinger's perspective that Kat and Lysa were constantly playing with him, which I'm not certain if I believe. And of course how he became Master of Coin, and we kind of know his story from that point forward, but it's all a very interesting backstory to, Littlefinger himself as well as his house. I'll just ask you, Axel, do you believe everything Littlefinger says in this particular one, or do you feel like some of it is more slanted towards his point of view?
Well, that's the thing about these being played from the character, you know? I don't know. I mean, I don't trust really anything he says, and I think that it's that's something that is kind of interesting, and that's why as an NBR, it's harder for me, because that had a little bit to do with why I asked, like, is everything in the books? Are they using these to lead a trail? Are there hints in what facts are represented and which are omitted? But the most interesting thing I found, well, to answer your question, no, I don't. The Braavos thing was the most interesting thing to me, because, you know, it's Braavos, man.
Yeah. And I love how the fact, you know, we've had Tyrion, when he first took over as Master of Coin, he saw that Littlefinger had made all of these deals with the Iron Bank of Braavos in terms of, you know, financing things and what have you. And that has created this huge debt. And now you can see why maybe Baelish, out of all of those people of the Master, or all of those people on the council, would have an easier aspect of dealing with the Iron Bank of Braavos. Maybe even be able to put off some of these debts, but now that he's not there, that may be coming back to haunt them. So I love that kind of connection. I think it's great that you bring up the Braavos point. Heath, did you see this particular feature?
I did. It was the last one I saw. But yeah, no, it was great, because it just reinforced. I love how the thing between Baelish and Lysa, and just the whole, how he wanted, he lost the fight, but then he used his mind to advance in the world. And I started thinking of Varys, and then I started going on tangents, of course, of thinking about Game of Thrones. But yeah, I don't know if to believe him or not, but he's Carcetti / Baelish, so I, you know, I'm in.
If there's one thing that I do believe from the Littlefinger point of view about House Baelish, is that at the end he says, you know, who knows what rungs or how high that House Baelish will climb. And he says, But don't count me out yet. Yeah, I think he's talking about potential heirs, but he says, don't count me out yet. I'm not done. And I think we can all probably expect that Littlefinger will still be very much in the game as we go along. We're moving on to Dragons now, and this one is by Julian Glover, who plays Grandmaster Pycelle, which I'm sure Bubba appreciated. He'll probably be doing a new impression of that next time I talk to him about the Blu-rays and DVDs.
Dragons are bad.
Yes, probably will.
Dragons, here we go. Just go into some of the things about them. There's a lot of Valyrian history here, and about, you know, the dragons, the origin of Valyria using dragons and how they use them. There's also the talk of this civil war called the Dance of Dragons, which was essentially a civil war between Targaryens in Westeros regarding getting the throne. But the way it pertains to dragons is the fact that a lot of the large dragons were killed during this particular civil war, and that gives us an origin as to a possible reason for the ultimate diminishment and extinction of dragons, to the point where it seems like you need the larger ones in order to keep the species alive. And that's why we've heard Tywin talk about the fact that, you know, you see the big heads of the dragons, some that Arya played in back in season one, and then how they successively got smaller to the point where Tywin was telling, I guess, Joffrey that the last one was maybe the size of a dog's head. And it seems to me that, at least as far as Westeros is concerned in dragons, that this Dance of Dragons, this civil war where some of the larger ones were killed, is the origin of that. Right, Heath?
Histories and lore really, it's almost like, I want to, you know, you watch them and you listen to them, and then it's like, I want to watch them once and then take notes. Because, they're short, but, man, they're impactful. And they really add to, there's a lot of information here. And part of it, I'm like, okay, did I hear it on the show? Did I hear it on Podcast Winterfell? Was I dreaming about Bubba and Catfish and hearing this stuff? It's amazing how, like, just dealing with the dragons, how what happened to the dragons in the past and everything, and now what is going to happen in the future with the rebirth of the dragons. And so I'm kind of like, I'm like torn, because it's like, you know, they mention a part where, was it that if you can't, oh God, and you can cut this out if you have to, Matt, because I'm going to ask you a question, but something about riding a dragon and jumping off a dragon and it just doesn't work. Am I mixing something up here?
Well, I don't know if they're, you know, it seems to me, in regards to dragons, of course, one thing that Pycelle mentions is that they're fire made flesh, which would tend to make you think that only Targaryens could ride a dragon, right? But what we get here, also, of course, we remember Viserys. He was not immune to hot gold. He died from that. We remember from this history, we know that Aegon V died in a fire trying to revive dragons, which is very related to what Dany did. Obviously, she survived. He did not. Mm-hmm. So we have to talk about the fact that perhaps, you know, Dany's instance of being able to do this, maybe it's not just about the fact that she has Targaryen blood, but maybe something really special did happen to her, because since the death of dragons, it doesn't seem like any of the Targaryens were resistant to hot things the same way that she is, right?
Yeah, she's definitely, and that's one of the, it's been discussed, but when you bring it out like that, it's almost like, okay, wait a minute, there's something more deeper here, and it's almost like we forgot it, or, you know, I'm speaking for myself, but there's got to be, like, where Dany at times seems defeated and she's going on this journey, but yet when it comes down to it, she's, I mean, if one of the dragons blew fire on her, would she die, or would she be able to take it? I mean, we've seen little doses, and of course the big one at the end of season one, but that's got to mean something big in the bigger picture.
I agree. I think it does too, very much so. Well, let's move on to Poisons then, which is, again, narrated by Pedro Pascal, who plays Oberyn Martell. That is the fourth one, and we get the mentions of the Strangler, the mention of Essence of Nightshade, Basilic Blood, Widow's Blood, and the Tears of Lys, and there's a couple of them that we've heard before. Of course, the Strangler, season four, that was what Pycelle said was used at Joffrey's wedding. Very complicated to make, so I'm assuming that if Littlefinger had it made, he paid a lot of money for it. Also an interesting thing that it's used by faceless men, which of course is a callback to Jaqen and Hagar. The Essence of Nightshade, now that is what Pycelle made for Cersei before the Battle of Blackwater in season two, and we saw her about to give it to Tommen, at the end of the battle when she thought all was lost until Tywin came in. Now, Basilisk's blood, I'm not sure if we've seen that one on the show, but that seems kind of nasty. It, to me, Heath, that almost seemed more like a steroid of such or something. It's something that alters the mind maybe more so than anything else. It attacks the mind.
Yeah, this is, you know, we've dealt with some poisons, like you mentioned, but I'm interested to see if we're going to see these others. I mean, these seem very vicious, like you're attacking the mind. Now, you know, when you say that, I think of the scene with the Mountain getting his, like, blood transfusion, and I'm wondering if something's going to counteract with that. They use, I don't know. It's interesting, but, I mean, the whole battle of the mind thing, that could be vicious. I'm a little scared now. At what poisons could be used in future seasons, and who would get attacked with them, and would they put them on weapons, and you could just have a whole mass hysteria going on with, if you know, biological warfare, if they decided to go that route. So it's actually a little freaky when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Oberyn being the master, I love that they had Oberyn do this, because something that I'm not sure if the show really demonstrated really well, is the fact that Oberyn, he spent time in the Citadel, learning about poisons. That's why he's so good with them. And that's why he's the authority on this particular feature. Another one mentioned is Widow's Blood, which I'm not sure that we've seen that one, but that one sounds pretty agonizing, getting the bowels going and everything. Tears of Lys. Odorless, and it seems like a normal death if you're old. This is the poison that Lysa Arryn, according to Varys, way back in season one, episode five, he sat down with Ned and identified the poison as the Tears of Lys that was used on Jon Arryn. So when we find out that Lysa Arryn used this one, in season, we find that out in season four. Now we see, you know, Arryn was kind of an old guy, so it would make sense that she would choose that particular poison, or that Littlefinger would choose that particular poison for her, to make it seem like his death was a little more natural, than it had been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as, Oberyn himself goes, you know, now we know the whole backstory of how he got the nickname the Red Viper. And I love that, you know, his little battle with a guy who was mad at him for being with two women, for just being a Dornishman.
Yeah.
You know, and you couldn't do any mortal wounding. I love the fact that it's kind of ambiguous as to whether he actually poisoned him or not, but I suspect that he did. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. He probably did. But you know what? It's freaking Oberyn, man. He can do whatever he wants. You know, it's funny. SNL should do a Game of Thrones skit about a poison shop. And they could go so many routes with that. But because I remember when Pycelle was reading off at Tyrion's trial all the poisons, and it's just like the names are just, it gets you. It's like, what? But that one you mentioned about the bowel thing, yeah, no, I don't like that one either. I don't know who would, but...
Yeah.
On the privy, maybe. You could, you know. CCP.
And maybe Tywin was on the privy because somebody had given him a dose of widow's blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Big. Let's make Shay look really good here. Shay was giving Tywin widow's blood, so he was on the privy, and that's, even though it cost Shay her life, she was actually doing good for Tyrion. Yeah.
That's the ticket. Yeah, no, I like that. I like that new crackpot theory. I'm sold. I'm in.
Yes, we'll move on to the Bastards of Westeros here. This one is told by Alaria Sand, who is, of course, Oberyn's paramour, and she is played by, let's see here, Indira Varma. Do I say that name correctly, Heath? Because I have no idea.
That sounds good to me.
All right. There's a couple of things that she mentions, and that is all of the sand names that you can possibly be. You could be the Flowers in the Reach, which is the name that my Game of Thrones, my character takes. You can be Hill in the Westerlands. That's like where the Lannisters are, Casterly Rock and all of that. You can be a Stone in the Vale. And, of course, we have Littlefinger out there. I don't know if we've met any Vale bastards named Stone. You can be a Sand, of course, in Dorne, a Snow, of course, in the North, a Storm in the Stormlands, Rivers in the Riverlands, Waters in the Crownlands. Now, the Crownlands are the area around King's Landing, just in case somebody doesn't know. I'll just fill that in from a book perspective. That's what they call the Crownlands. I don't know if that's ever been explained in the television show or not. And then, of course, Pike in the Iron Islands. So you get all of those names, and I don't know, Heath, out of all of those names, do you have a favorite other than Snow?
I like Storm. That just sounds awesome.
Well, there are probably a lot of storms running around out there, given that Robert is originally from the Stormlands.
Yeah, right. Heath Storm. That might be my season 5 name.
Right on, right on. I kind of like Rivers as well, being from the Riverlands. That's the area where the Tullys are from. Now, here's one interesting thing to talk about, Heath, and that is in this feature, it says that a king can legitimize a bastard to become their rightful heir. I think that's been said on the show as well, but I can't recall exactly. But it makes me think of a couple bastards who could really change the story in terms of ruling if they were legitimized. The first one, of course, being obviously Jon Snow. If he was legitimized by a king, perhaps now that we have a King Stannis north of the Wall, mm-hmm. could be very interesting to see him become Jon Stark and see what he would do in terms of Winterfell or the Wall or what he might choose. And, of course, the other one is Gendry. This is the one I think of, who is still out there rowing on a boat somewhere all through season 4. But if he ever gets back and could find some way for a king to legitimize him, since he's bastard of Robert Baratheon, then he would become an actual heir to the Iron Throne. I don't know if more so an heir than Stannis. I think he would be more so than an heir to Stannis if he was legitimized. But being from King's Landing right now, he's from the Crownlands, so that makes his bastard name, which I don't think we've ever seen on the show, he would be, what, a Waters, Gendry Waters. No wonder they don't say his last name on the show.
Sounds like a pop star back in, but who could legitimize, Gendry then? Would it have to be Stannis, because he's a Baratheon?
I think it could be a lord or a king. The show seems to go more towards a king. And given Stannis wants the Iron Throne for himself, I doubt he would legitimize Gendry, especially since he was going to kill him.
Yeah, exactly.
But Tommen could legitimize him as well. Of course, Tommen wouldn't want to because then his reign would be over.
Yeah, so it's almost like if Jon Snow became a Stark, that wouldn't necessarily, I'm trying to think how that would work. Stark and Baratheon fighting together, it would probably be useful. But that's interesting. Because we saw Roose Bolton give Ramsay the Bolton name this past season, correct?
You're right. And yeah. I'm trying to remember, that was that a decree from the king that he presented him with?
Yeah, I, you know, I don't know who did Roose Bolton, is he, so he's not able to do that on his own. Was that from given from someone else?
I can't recall exactly, yeah. And maybe some of our listeners can let us in. It seemed like the piece of paper that he held out was supposedly from the realm.
So
it might have been Tommen that legitimized him or had to legitimize him, or it might even have been from Joffrey. It could have been that far back. And that would make more sense because what it says to me is part of this deal that Roose Bolton made with Tywin and with the Freys in accordance with the, Red Wedding. Actually, kind of coordinated. Maybe that was one of the stipulations. And maybe Ramsay has been legitimized for a while and Bolton's just been holding on to it.
Oh. You know, that makes sense because, Tywin with all his letter writing, maybe that must have been one of the stipulations but he probably had that in his back pocket to see how Ramsay would perform and whether he'd be, worthy of the Bolton name. So yeah, you're right. It probably had to come from someone and, probably from the Lannisters, and then he just kind of held on to it to see what would happen.
Yeah, I agree. Well, let's move on to the Iron Bank, I think is the next feature on the list. And this, of course, is talked about by Mark Gatiss, the actor who plays, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this name or not, in the TV show yet, but they list him as Tycho Nestoris. The Iron Banker of Braavos. This is a very interesting history to me also about how the Iron Bank, essentially Braavos was formed, trying to flee all of the dragons in Valyria, and kind of this hiding place, with the big, you know, they built a big statue many years later after Valyria was destroyed, but they were essentially fleeing the dragons. And the dragon masters. And then they started to pull their resources together, to profit by loaning to others. And the Iron Bank gets its name, from all of the gold being stored in an old iron mine. And they, of course, being resourceful and never wasting resources, they still keep that, as a, I guess, a secondary vault or perhaps the primary vault still. And then, of course, something that we've all been able to kind of gather information about through the series in seasons 3 and seasons 4 is that this is a very powerful bank. You don't want to mess with these guys. They even fund other banks. You know, they fund everyone from merchants to kings, at a really severe cost, if not repaid. Again, just putting this in the context of everything. Stannis is now gone to this Bank of Braavos, and Davos did an eloquent argument as to why they should fund him instead of the Lannisters. And of course, we know the Lannisters have no gold from season 4 to pay them back with anyway. There's even a mention during the Red Wedding. I love this that Lady Olenna tells, Tywin back in season 4 during, or not the Red Wedding, the Purple Wedding, pardon me, that, Margaery tells Tywin that, you know, he's going to need her help again soon. And they're talking about this whole debt thing. So it seems to me, and this is an aspect of George's writing, and the storytelling, by Dave and Dan, that, you know, nobody talks about how these wars are financed in high fantasy. And I love that they kind of get into those kind of side details. I also love that, you know, the money people are the people you have to fear. It seems like, it almost makes them kind of mafia-like in a way, which I find enjoyable and really threatening to just about anybody who goes back on them. So, what are your impressions of the Iron Bank in general, Heath? I mean, I don't know about the special-wise or anything else, but, do you feel like they're going to play a bigger part in the story in season 5?
Oh, it's got to. And I love, like, it's a great point you say, like, in fantasy, you kind of, okay, dragons and sell swords and all kinds of neat stuff. But the fact that the money and the, you know, we have had a lot of politics, but now that money's involved. And as you know, as we all know, money plays a huge part in everything, even war today. a lot of money's made from private contractors and government contracts and all kinds of stuff. So it's pretty awesome that George went this route. And think about the change in power where Stannis was, and now with getting the money and be able to hire people and being able to then get, you know, you get the backing of the number one bank, you know, Fort Knox or whatever. And it's got to play a big role. And you would think, you know, what is the only way that the Iron Bank would get defeated? And as if they went bankrupt, but it doesn't look like that's coming anytime soon. So whoever the Iron Bank is backing, you got to believe is definitely on the right track. And if you owe them money, as you mentioned, mafia, like, you better watch out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And does that make you root for Stannis anymore? Have you changed your mind about Stannis now? The fact that the most powerful bank in all the world is backing him. I mean, does that give you hope that someday he will actually sit on the Iron Throne, or do you think that he's going to be a goner?
You know, I don't know. Like, I like and I don't like Stannis. It's like him. I like and I don't, but I love Davos. I love Melisandre, but don't trust her. And I'm still, like, hoping somehow the Starks are going to come back together at the end. But, you know, I'm confused because I think it's good right now that the Iron Bank is backing Stannis. But I don't know long term if he's the answer to rule. I'm not sold on that yet, but I'm not quite sure, but to be honest, if I was the Iron Bank, I don't know if I would have backed Stannis. I really don't. I mean, Davos' speech was great and I'm glad it happened because then it led to, helping out Jon Snow and that whole, part of the story, but I'm still a little shaky at can he be the one to lead, and I don't know if I want him on the Iron Throne, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's fair enough. I like Stannis because he's a curmudgeon, but I don't know how well that translates to ruling myself. I share the same concerns you do. And of course, ruling's what this whole series is all about, and that brings us to the next history in Lords, which is Robert's Rebellion. This one, again, told by Pedro Pascal as Oberyn Martell, because it specifically outlines to me exactly why Oberyn is so obsessed with the Lannisters. And, there's got this bit again about his sister, Aelia, and you totally understand. You just hear it in Oberyn's voice, in the way that Pedro Pascal vocalized this history, as to how much it meant to him to lose his sister and his niece and nephew, and why he was so obsessed with the Mountain. It really informs that, as if the first episode of season four didn't, when he was talking to Tyrion, but this even magnifies it to a greater degree. And I really love that. You also get some nice stuff about Rhaegar and Lyanna. Once again, that was Ned Stark's sister. And how that really triggered the whole, Robert's Rebellion. Now, some of this stuff, I will say, is repetitive from what we've heard in, like, prior season history and lores. And some of the stuff expands upon, and some of the stuff contracts upon some of the stuff that we've heard before. But I always find it interesting. Robert's Rebellion seems to me to be the most interesting aspect, since it's the nearest in the history of everything. And we can get a perspective of where some of these characters who were actually alive at the time of this get some of their motivations, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, so Robert's Rebellion definitely is a fascinating aspect of the story. And again, I'll bring up the whole Rhaegar Lyanna thing. That's of special interest to book readers. I won't say anything more than that. But it just seems like, you know, so much is confluenced around that particular event. The fact that Rhaegar captured Lyanna, that It feels like to me that this is in season or in episode one of season four. Oberyn made it sound like that Rhaegar left Aelya, his sister, to be with this Lyanna girl, or for a girl from the north. I don't think he specifically said her name, but here we get a specific name. So what does that imply to you, Heath? I mean, does it imply that maybe it wasn't just a kidnapping for the sake of, I don't know, for the sake of being mean to the Starks? It was more a kidnapping for another reason. And was it actually a kidnapping? Could Lyanna have gone willingly?
Yeah, and that's the question. Like, we find out that, you know, Lysa Arryn poisoned her husband, and now, you know, we get different perspectives of what happened, but then as new information comes out or different points of view, you're like, wait a minute, maybe it's not cut and dry like we thought. So it just adds so much. There's a lot of layers, different points of view, and you're like, wait a minute, maybe it didn't happen like this. And so, and then you start thinking of Baelish's mind, and you're like, the way he manipulates, and everyone's been trying to manipulate everyone else, and you think one thing from one character, but then you hear another. So, you know, that's a great question. And, now I wonder, like, half the stuff we've heard, is it true? It's what makes this world great, because it's not, it's a story that isn't just necessarily cut and dry. This is what happened, blah, blah, blah. Even down to Jaime, the Kingslayer. We finally, you know, last season or two seasons ago, got the real reason why he did what he did. And it was to, you know, he wasn't going to kill his father, and he had to save a lot of people. But yet, most people from their point of view, especially with Ned, it was like, you know, he was a Kingslayer, a traitor, you know, and, you know, he stabbed him in the back. But there's different motivations and different reasons, but people see what they want to see sometimes, and it's not always the truth.
Exactly, exactly. It does come down to what point of view we hear from, because in the season one extras, we hear a lot about Robert's rebellion from Robert himself and his point of view, and he makes Rhaegar seem very evil. On the other hand, we hear from Oberyn Martell, which also makes him seem very evil, but maybe not for the same evil reasons that Robert makes him sound like. So it's very interesting. Again, this is another tribute to the book's facts, or to the book perspectives, for the fact that maybe not all of our narrators are reliable. Constantly, Ken from Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things used to talk about, is our narrator reliable here, when we've been talking about the books? And even has stretched that to the television show. So I think it's important to keep that aspect in mind as you watch all of these histories and lore, and compare the different ones that address the same subject and see where the difference of viewpoint is. Because Heath, just like you mentioned, throughout the show, we've seen our viewpoint of different aspects of things change. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, with Jaime, that's a great point. Now, a very slanted point, and I don't know if you trust his viewpoint or not, but we do love him. That would be the gentleman who's talking about sellswords and hedge knights, and that's, of course, Jerome Flynn, who plays Bronn, who is narrating all of that stuff in terms of that particular feature. And it's more or less him trying to sell himself as a sellsword. But there is a mention of a few important companies, sellsword companies in Essos, some that we've met before, like the Second Sons. That's where, of course, our friend Dario is from. We met them in season three. This Golden Company is a huge one. And that's mentioned throughout all of these histories and Blu-rays as well. And you have to ask yourself, we've heard them mentioned before in the show, I believe, but will we ever meet them? Or the Windblown, will we ever meet them? Why mention them if they're not important in terms of the aspect of the overall story? So, not to spoil anything, because I don't know, who we will meet from different companies and what have you. But given that they're all in Essos, is it a bigger source for Danny to tap into? Is it a source that might fight Danny? It's all very interesting, and it leads to a lot of possibilities, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Again, God, there's a lot of information and a lot, you know, I think it's going one way and then you're like, wait a minute. And then you just explain. I mean, there's so many references to Cell Swords and of course following Braun and whatnot, but it's just like, okay, now again, I mean, down to Cell Swords, it's comes down to money. I mean, Braun's, you know, when I remember when Tyrion's talking about, would you kill a baby? And he's like, how much, you know, it's, it's like, man, it's just, who's got, it just boggles the mind. Like, anyone could turn on you, if more money is maybe brought. I mean, is there loyalty? But you're right, a source that Danny could tap into, that sounds like a good idea to me.
So we'll have to see what happens with all of that, you know, and it's interesting that it's brought up here. As opposed to the end of season 3 when we first met a sellsword company. But we'll have to see what that means in terms of the context of the story in the future. Now, one really great line, from Jerome Flynn or from Braun in this is that sellswords never flee from the losing side. So for me, that put into the context of the flipping of companies that you might almost, that might something be something that you almost expect, which makes me worry not so much about the Unsullied for Danny, but the Second Sons that are fighting with Danny that Dario went to go fight off the Yunkai with. Should we worry about that? Should we worry about, you know, Bronn flipping sides somewhere in his future with someone? It's lovely background information to help you speculate about the future. And as far as the Hedge Knights go, basically, it's another cute line. He says, take a sellsword and remove the synths, which just made me totally laugh out loud. You know, Hedge Knights are like the guys that want to be included in a house or become part of a greater army or whatever. And so they go around fighting in these tournaments and such. We probably saw some Hedge Knights fighting in that very first jousting match way back in King's Landing when Sansa was attending and being told stories by Littlefinger about the Mountain and the Hound. Now, neither of those were sellswords, but maybe somewhere along the line, you would have seen someone get taken out during the course of that tourney that might have been a Hedge Knight. So, all interesting stuff there. And we're really getting into a pretty deep discussion here about these histories and stuff. So, I'm just going to go through the rest of these and put some bullet points in them. And then I'll just ask a couple of questions at the end here, if that's cool. Where are we at here? Let's go to The Wall, which is told by John Bradley, who plays Samwell. And some interesting points about this particular one is the aspect of, again, something that we've heard in the season 1 Blu-rays, which is the origins of The Wall. The most interesting thing is the different attempts, to come through the wall, by different bands of wildlings in the past. Some that we have heard about, some that we haven't. For instance, the Grendel's Children story that about the Grendel's Children who came, through the caves underneath the wall. Now in the books, I know Ygritte tells that story to John. I don't know if it's been directly, told, to that extent in the television show. But it's something, again, that builds the world quite a bit. And there's other kings beyond the wall that are mentioned as well. The most interesting aspect of that is that the fact that the wall is not being maintained in the same way that it was in the past that Samwell mentions. And it kind of explains the peril of not only of Mance, but perhaps the peril of the White Walkers possibly finding a way to come through as well. And of course it sets up the whole, battle with Mance's army that we saw in episode 9 of season 4. So it's great for that aspect of giving you an idea of what has to be done to defend the wall, as Mance comes. Nations of the North, told by Tormund Giantsbane, who is played by, this is the name I'm gonna butcher, Christopher, Hivju. Is that how you say his name? I have no idea. But nonetheless, a couple of bullet points about that. You get the names of the different tribes. For instance, the Hornfoots, the Thins are very fleshed out in this particular one, and of course we saw aspects of their story. They were the ones traveling with Tormund and Ygritte in season 4. The Giantsbane story about giants, and that makes me remember the story of the bear, of course, that Tormund Giantsbane told last year as well. And, of course, the whole bit about the White Walkers coming and Mance uniting all of these tribes, that's kind of all stuff that we even got as early as season 3 in the television show. Then there's two stories of the Kingsguard, one from Jaime Lannister, who is, of course, played by Nikolai Coster-Waldau. A lot of great names in this, in his thing, telling about the history of some of the great knights of the Kingsguard. And some of them are really exciting for book readers, names like Sir Arthur Dayne and Sir Duncan the Tall. The other one is from Bronn, who was of course played by Jerome Flynn. Book reader references to like Aemon the Dragon Knight and again the Civil War that we were talking about earlier, the Dance with Dragons. Another mention of Arthur Dayne as well and his role, possibly regarding Lyanna, because remember, Rhaegar was a Targaryen, and so he was guarded by the Kingsguard and the whole thing with Lyanna. And, there's a lot of aspects there that are fun. And of course, the praising of Jaime Lannister is kind of interesting as well. We also have the Maester's Chain, which is told by Qyburn, who is played by Anton Lesser on the television show. This one is kind of interesting because you get all the, again, the different metals of the chain explained. I think we've kind of gotten that before, but it's a nice reminder. This mention of dragon glass candles, that's a great thing for BRs to pay attention to. I don't know if the television show is going to cover any of that or if this is, again, just world building. Most important, though, is the explanation of Qyburn getting expelled. They will look at the dead and ask, what if, is one of the things, or he says, they will look at the dead and ask, what if? And this may be a clue about the mountain, whether he's going to survive in season 5. Or it could be also the fact that, you know, he seems to be much more about the magic, or talking a lot about the magic in the world and how the maesters look down on that. Think of what else comes back from the dead. Thoros of Myr brings people back from the dead, brought Beric Dondarrion. The White Walkers bring the dead back, the zombies back, which are, we call whites. So there's a lot of interesting aspects of that. The next feature is, told by Conleth Hill, who plays Varys, and his is The Death of Kings, which talks about past kings and how they've all died, like the dance, again, the Dance of Dragons. That's kind of a sister, again, that Civil War, and there's a little bit bigger explanation about a sister and brother Targaryens, it also ties it to Aemon the Dragon Knight. I think, in a way. There's the mention of the Blackfyre Rebellions, where all of the bastards of a particular king, he legitimized them, which again ties to the Bastards of Westeros, and they tried to overtake the Targaryens of the true bloodline. This is the group, these Blackfyres, is the group that, again, a sellsword company that we've mentioned before, the Golden Company, they're kind of descended from. Daemon Blackfyre's line, part of the Nine Penny Kings War, Selmy took a lot of them out, but, descendants of those who fought with them are in the Golden Company. Now, Varys says something very interesting, and he says that the War of Five Kings will obviously end with the death of four. The five kings, of course, that we know are Baelin, Renly, Stannis, Robb, and the Lannister. So that would either be Joffrey or perhaps Tommen now. So let's look at who has died. Renly is gone. Robb is gone. But that still leaves Baelon in the TV show, Stannis, and Tommen. So out of those three, who do you guys think would die, send me an email at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. I don't really want to see Tommen die. He seems like a pretty sweet kid. On the other hand, I don't really want to see Stannis die either. I would gladly welcome the death of Baelon. I don't think he serves much in terms of the story right now. Moving on to the history of the Valyrian Steel, told by Ian Glynn, who plays Jorah Mormont. I love this story about the Valyrian Steel, not so much about what Valyrian Steel is about, but the way it ties to Jorah's story and how he was so broke, their house was so broke because, for reasons of his past, let's just say, that he started selling slaves, but still wouldn't sell Longclaw. So that is very interesting, to the aspect of it. That, of course, selling the slaves is what ended up getting him exiled and ended up with him getting with Daenerys. And now who knows what's in Jorah's future in terms of that, because he's been banished by Daenerys. So we'll have to see what happens there. Another, book reader note is the mention of Sir Duncan the Tall, who, by the way, as it ties into another of one of these histories, was a hedge knight. He started out, but he ended up in the Kingsguard. Another mention of Kingsguards in here. It's all of these histories are tied together into a past kind of, with the exception of a couple of them, beyond Robert's Rebellion, but less, but closer to us in terms of time than some of the stuff we got in terms of the history and lore of the first season. The first histories, were about the Age of Heroes and stuff very far in the past. Then we've gotten smatterings of the near past, and we've gotten a lot in this set about the somewhat distant past. 100 years or more seems to be the standpoint, but less than 1,000 years for the most part. It seems to be the standpoint for most of these histories, so that's very interesting. The final history on these is the Justice of the Seven Kingdoms, again told by Jerome Flynn, who plays Bronn. Talking about the different kinds of justice, it's more about a perspective about what justice is really here in Westeros. And again, it comes with that great Jerome Flynn cynicism that he gives Bronn, because Bronn is cynical about a lot of these kind of aspects that many people hold dear in Westeros, or at least those who claim to be honorable. Again, the different kinds of justice, how many different ways you can get punished and by whom and that kind of thing. The shout out to Ned Stark, of course, like the man who passes the sentence must wield the sword. I love also that there is a shout out to, Sir Duncan the Tall in this, which you may not be aware of, but it's present in one of the Duncan Egg, novellas, was this 7-on-7 trial by combat. And the Targaryen prince who died for a hedge knight. That's a great shout out to that particular book, or that particular novella as well, which we have covered on the podcast. So, feel free to go back to that episode and listen to it. That kind of does it for the history and Blu-rays. I'm going to real quickly just go through some real quick comments of mine about the commentaries. I know you're waiting to hear Axel and Heath speak again, and they shall, but we're getting really pressed for time here. So episode one of the commentaries and these are featured on both the Blu-rays and the DVDs, by the way. Episode one has Dave and Dan with Pedro Pascal. Actually, I usually find Dave and Dan commentaries to be a little bit boring, but they do have a pretty good sense of humor, thanks to Pedro being on the commentary as well, and it's pretty funny. Now, the episode two commentary comes from George R. R. Martin, who, of course, is the author of the source material, also Natalie Dormer, who plays Marjorie Tyrell, and Jack Gleason, who plays King Joffrey, and director Alex Graves. And it's kind of interesting that George brought up at one point in this commentary, he said there was some ambiguity about Bronn, as to whether he actually put Shay on the ship. And I think if you go back and listen to our initial reaction podcast, this was something that a question that some of us might have had as well. George, having made that question himself, made that concern much more real. Now, Graves does answer the question by saying that the way he understood it from Dave and Dan, Bronn did put Shay on the ship. and she left, or was taken later. So it's not clear as to which of those. There is a deleted scene, which we'll talk about real quickly in a second also, that the, Braun, and Shay, this deleted scene of Braun and Shay talking kind of makes the illusion to think that, that Braun inadvertently gives Shay the idea to adapt to her situation. So you kind of have a question remaining as to whether she was taken off the ship by force or if she chose to get off the ship, because Braun kind of gave her this idea. Either way, I think you can exonerate Braun himself, for having, taken an active part in Shay turning against Tyrion. But maybe in terms of suggestion, Shay may have made a choice on her own. So that's kind of interesting. The episode 4 commentary, because there isn't one on episode 3, has Michelle McLaren and Robert McLaughlin. Michelle, as a director, I can't imagine how much of a joy it must be to work for her, because she's just a really bubbly personality, very complimentary on everything, and very descriptive about different things about the episode, best to her recollection. And Robert McLaughlin's very interesting commentary on, you know, how scenes are shot, how they're lit, and that kind of thing. Episode 5 has a commentary from Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams, who play Sansa Stark and Arya Stark, respectively. If you're a 17-year-old, this is probably a good, pretty commentary, but most of the stuff that they say are in a pop culture context that go way over my head, so I didn't find as much humor in it as maybe some of our younger listeners would. It's not as good as some of their prior ones. And I miss the fact that Isaac Hempstead Wright was not on the commentary, who plays Bran, because he usually keeps things a little more grounded, even though I think he's probably the younger of the three of them. But I did kind of miss him on that one. The episode 6 commentary is Brian Cogman and Alex Sakharov, the director and writer of the episode, pardon me, the writer and director of the episode in that particular order. You know, Brian is one of those guardians of the books, and the TV show. So it's always fun to hear him make, certain book comparisons in his commentaries. They're not of spoilery variety either. They're just little notes about differences, and I love that. He reminds me a lot of the way Donald comments about differences between the books and the TV show. And not necessarily in a critical way, the way sometimes Donald does, but sometimes in the way that, are helpful to a reader or a TV show, because it explains that transformation. And Alex Sakharov is very good about how the sausage is made. So if you're into that kind of thing, then his commentary is great as well. Episode 7 features Aidan Gillen, who plays Littlefinger, Kate Dickey, who's a name you might not recognize, but she plays Lysa Arryn, and then producers Chris Newman and Bernadette Caulfield, who are in there. And it's kind of a sporadic commentary in the way that they spend time watching the episode rather than speaking to it. But it was kind of interesting to hear Kate Dickey's reaction, to Lysa's death, because evidently she doesn't watch any of her own stuff. So that was very interesting. The episode 8 commentary has production designer Deborah Riley, costume designer Michelle Clapton, and another name I'm gonna probably butcher, but director of photography Anna Helmick. That conversation is pretty interesting about shot selection, lighting, costume, sets, other tidbits about the production. The stuff that you make the world real, for us as viewers and for the actors and for everybody involved. These are the people that are behind that. And, so I really love that particular commentary. Episode 9 has 2 commentaries. The first one being from Kit Harington, who of course plays Jon Snow, Rose Leslie, who plays Ygritte, and John Bradley, who plays Samwell. This one to me was pretty awesome. It's one of my favorite ones. Great insight into the making of that particular episode, Watchers on the Wall, which helped supplement even the documentary on it as well. But it does, also allows them to give motivations of the characters. These guys really think about their characters, and there are some really deep thoughts as well as some good humor in the commentary. The other episode 9 commentary is from visual effects producer Steve Kaulbach and visual effects supervisor Joe Baer. And that's very interesting in terms of how the sausage is made in terms of the effects. So that probably goes really well hand in hand with the with the special Best Buy disc that Heath mentioned earlier, about the digital extensions to different sets and all that kind of thing. The episode 10 commentaries, and there are two of those as well. The first one is with Rory McGann, Gwendolyn Christie, who play the Hound, and of course Brienne, respectively. And then you have, once again, director Alex Graves. There's lots of fun insight about the making of this episode, how shots were changed, struggles with money, good humor from Gwen and Rory. And this is another one of my favorite commentaries. And then, the last commentary is from Peter Dinklage, who of course plays Tyrion Lannister, Lena Headey, who plays Cersei Lannister, and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who plays, Jaime Lannister. So all three of them, the Lannisters comment on a particular episode, and they're funny enough together. There's not a whole lot of insight in terms of whatever, the characters are going through or what have you, but they're fun to listen to. I did find the fact that Dinklage, knew from the very beginning that he would kill Tywin. That was kind of pitched, I guess, or was part of the initial pitch to him. That was an interesting little bit of insight. I didn't know how much they had told, Dinklage about Tyrion's character. It also went into the reason that, Tyrion went to Tywin's chambers, was to get at a truth and no intent for him to kill Shay. So that was a nice clarification as well. And that's it for the commentaries. So, just a couple more quick things to talk about. Two deleted scenes. One is the scene with Bronn that I talked about before. It's kind of an extension of the scene where Tyrion sends, Shay away and has Bronn take her away. And this conversation happens between Bronn and Shay about adapting how once you're used up that they have no use for you and that kind of thing. And, that's where, if you watch that scene, like I said, it almost seems like, Bronn, not necessarily on purpose, but he's talking about these higher ups and everything. And you almost see a little light twinkle in Shay's eye, like, that, he's given her an idea that if she can't be with Tyrion, then she'll turn against him. She has to adapt, as Bronn says. But that's just, you know, that's my interpretation of that scene. You all might have a different interpretation. Let me know at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. Also, the other scene is Daenerys and Missandei, and this is an extension of the scene where Jorah is sent away. You know, he rides off into the sunset, and then that night you see Dany and Missandei basically talking about, don't ever betray me is what Daenerys says to Missandei. Okay? She's very anti-betrayal. It kind of helps to fuel her motivation for sending Jorah away. And it's kind of sad. It was probably cut for time because this was the Mountain and the Viper episode and they hadn't gotten to King's Landing yet. And they needed a couple extra minutes for that Beatles speech, right? So that's probably why this was cut. anyway, so those are your deleted scenes. And then finally there's a blooper reel, which actually Game of Thrones released on their official YouTube back right after Comic-Con. They released this exact same blooper reel. So nothing really new there. It's funny enough. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. But for me, it was just kind of like, well, they just did it again. You know, they just, took stuff from previous, stuff that they'd released and stuck it on the disc. So that was kind of disappointing. But, I guess we should get back to Axel and Heath here. We've kind of already discussed the favorite feature and the least favorite feature, but, Axel, let me ask you real quick, which was your favorite history when you watched them?
I think my favorite delivery was the Cell Swords and Hedge Knights.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was so funny how he was like, a Cell Sword. It is what it sounds like. It's how you sword. I don't know if I, that's what, you know, that's the thing is that a lot of these, not one like really jumped out to me. Mm-hmm. I love everything having to do with the wall. So that's cool. I liked learning about the two houses. I don't know. I don't really think that I had a favorite one. I think that these were, I don't think they were mediocre, but I guess they weren't as entrancing as some of the more of the beyond the wall stuff that had been included earlier.
Understood. I think that's a valuable opinion to have because, these histories, are very laden with little details that maybe book readers would get excited about more so than TV watchers. So that's fun for us. And I think that in context with what we might see in the future, some of this stuff will be more important to just, TV viewers when they go back and look at these after watching season 5. But speaking of season 5, just from a BR or an MBR perspective, we know that, as Axel has brought up prior, I believe in our top 5 countdown or our top WTF moments countdown, that, there's gonna be some differences between the books and the show. And Axel, I know that you wanted to talk about that again. Why don't you lead us in that discussion, sir?
Yeah, well, Heath and I had discussed this a little bit, last week on, the film list. You got a list, send it to him, thefilmlist@gmail.com.
Cool.
We had discussed how I have this kind of theory. You know, a couple weeks ago or a month or a little bit more ago, there was an article that popped up on some of the geeky sites saying, you know, that Railroad was saying that book readers are not going to be happy about this season. And I don't think that this is spoilerish for me to say this because, I mean, I'm pretty spoiler phobic and I don't think it's spoilerish. But Matt, you're free to edit this part out if you wish, that people are going to die in the TV show that are alive still in the books and vice versa, that people, you know, that's going to happen more often. And that this season in particular, we're going to see a greater rift between the books and the show in more direct ways. Now, I know the biggest thing, so I thought we could talk about it since you're a book reader and Heath is like, we got to come up with a new one. He's an ABR, an asleep book reader. Like he read the books, but he was kind of asleep.
Yeah, and I don't remember
it. He doesn't remember it. No, okay, so instead an amnesiatic book reader.
Whoa.
There so you I'm go, right?
ABR?
You're right. An ABR.
I like it.
Which is kind of the concept of is that prospect exciting to you? Is it do you think that it's bad, like it's taking away from the source material? Because the biggest thing we had before was the handing off of the baby to like this whatever it was, White Walker, and seeing that whole like kind of castle or whatever formation it was, and they're all set. Like, as far as my understanding is, that is the largest divergence from the source material so far. Would you agree with me on that or no?
It's yet to actually be determined whether it's a divergence or not. But what I can tell you, and this is why MBR, or pardon me, why BRs, and perhaps ABRs were a little miffed by that scene because it hasn't appeared in the books, but might. So I think that most book readers felt like they were getting spoiled rather than more so than it being a divergence in the story.
Yeah, now that you're talking, now it's kind of bringing me back to when that happened. And I guess I just never understood that. Because how do you know the timing of what occurred? I mean, I guess you could know the time. Wait, so that's what I didn't get is if it hadn't happened yet, then all the events that led up to it hadn't happened. So that's what I don't understand, because there were direct events that clue you in to what other people were doing at that time that happened, that right. Handing off of that particular baby.
Right.
So doesn't that show you it didn't happen yet? Or you're saying it didn't happen yet because of the way the books have been written, where you're in the midst of this feast dance tandem, where it is a retelling of things that already occurred. So chronology in this world, or the way this story is told, isn't held fast. So people are thinking, oh, but he may have gone back and told us that later.
Right. And that's exactly what I think it is about.
It's weird. Isn't that weird? Axel,
well, it's kind of interesting because just in the same way, let's take Theon, for instance. All of that torture stuff in season 3 is really only alluded to in book 5, in A Dance with Dragons. You don't find out about that until a good portion of even what we're going to see in this upcoming season, I suspect. You don't find out that in terms of the book chronology, until later on. So, this is what I liken it to. Dave and Dan are like that gentleman who put Lost in order, right? That our friends Miss Wendy and Anna are podcasting about, right? They're kind of doing the same thing with their television show. They're taking bits from the books that happen in retrospect or happen from memory or whatever, and then they're placing them in the proper context in the order of time. So the fact of the matter is that throughout George's books, none of that stuff about the White Walker has been revealed yet. It's been hinted at, but it's been kind of a mystery, and I think that's why MBR, or why book readers were so upset about that particular scene. For me, it didn't matter. I had, you know, but that's just my own personal taste and the fact that I respect that everybody's that Dave and Dan are trying to put things in the order that they come rather than the order that they are revealed in the books. So that didn't really bother me. But to your larger question as to whether, book readers are going to be spoiled by aspects of this television story, there are some things that I can definitely say, and that is we are at the end of Sansa's story, really, in the books, by the conclusion of season 4. There may be one other chapter that they could take some stuff from. I think you've even seen interviews with Sophie Turner that's saying, you know, so that Sansa is very ambiguous going forward because nobody knows in regards to her character. I'm excited about that. I can't wait to find out more. And it won't lessen my book experience. But there are book readers who feel like that the TV show is going to spoil their book experience because they've had to wait on George. And I don't know how that will affect viewership of the show. I really don't think so, because I think it's increasing more on the TV side than it is on the book reader normals who've been following along and criticizing what they did right and what they did wrong, you know. Okay, I've spieled on off a lot about that, but if you were a book reader, Axel, and you had started reading Game of Thrones back in 1998 and been waiting years and years for books and books and books, how would your experience be different, or would you still want to experience the television show first?
Well, I can only liken it to other times that I've read a book and that it's been made into a film or a television show. Or like with Homicide and The Wire, I went back and read the David Simon book Homicide, which has a lot of both of those shows in it. I honestly don't care what is changed. The thing that I care about, and it's the same thing when they like remake a movie, is if the intent, if I feel, and it's totally subjective, if I feel that the intent of the creators is true to the story, then it doesn't matter to me what changes they make.
Right.
I might be surprised by one. I might dislike another. I might love another. I might wish they had done something else. But I kind of see it as a separate thing. But I think it's fascinating. And I don't want to – you can edit this out if you think it's a spoiler too. But there are, I guess, reports, and I don't know what scenes or anything, that they're going to do flashbacks next season for the first time. And like I said, feel free to edit out. I hope you don't feel like that's a spoiler, Heath Solo. But those have happened in the book, I guess, already, right? Or I guess – I mean – it leads me to believe that maybe they're starting to bring that this season might be about that on a meta scale, that they may start messing with time. And, you know, there's always that theory that has been out there. That's what's happening in Westeros and all that area is at a different time than what's happening with Khaleesi over in what's, I guess, is that the Essos area?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, it's coming back to me. But that's been dispelled at different times too. But I remember when I was first watching the show, and probably one of the first, that's probably one of the first theories I had on podcast Winterfell, because it's Lost-like.
Right.
But it makes me wonder then, if they do start doing that and different people are dying or whatever, then how different changes are going to affect the book readers. Whereas for us, you know, NBRs, we're just going to keep on riding the ship and thinking they added something cool to the show. So I don't know. What do you think? Do you think they might be doing that? I mean, you don't – have you heard that same report as I have that they are doing flashbacks?
I have heard the thing about flashbacks and about the fact that there are deaths coming that haven't happened in the books yet. And so I don't know
– yet.
Yeah. Again, I put that in context just because George's story is so expanded right now where he is in the books that people are going to have to die in order to contract, the story to get back to where, it comes to a satisfying resolution. So I don't know that it just because, even in past seasons, Eerie died in season two. She's still alive in the books. Right now, even as far as the fifth book. Let's see, who else? Grin and Pip are still alive in the books. And of course they were killed in the Battle of Blackwater, and David Dan needed to do that in order to create some kind of actual dramatic effect to the death. So just because there are going to be deaths, as George says, will they be significant? I don't know. I can't tell you. I don't know how it will affect my feeling about the story in general. I do know that Dave and Dan have bullet points to where George intends the books to go at the end. How they get there is going to be a completely different story. Again, and I've said this many times on this podcast, so I'm not worried about how they get there so much as, you know, I think the big thing for a lot of book readers will be the end points when they get to season 7 and Winds of Winter has just come out. And there's still another whole book to go. That's where I think you're going to see a real dividing line. Now, in terms of changing locations for different characters, I feel like that's going to happen a lot this year. That won't affect me one way or the other at all. Because I feel like, you got to make some things that are in this tandem read, as you mentioned, more interesting. And so I'm not that worried about it. You know, we'll all get through it together. We'll be holding hands in some aspects of the story for sure and saying, what the heck is going on? And I find that personally exciting. I don't know about you.
Yeah, that's what I think overall. I hope, and when Heath and I had spoken about this last week, I had said that so far, I think that the Game of Thrones community, the people who have read the books, have been really cool. I don't know if I've ever been spoiled on something, things here or there, but I might have been looking, you know? And, I find that most people have had a not, you know, horrific response when something's changed in the book or in, the TV series, because I think that they know that the show, if the book was there, they would probably do it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
They're kind of up against it. That's what I mean. Like, you can't really blame these guys at this point, because we've talked earlier about the Blu-rays and how much time and effort goes into making this whole show. So this business, this train has to keep on going.
Right.
They can't stop for 4 years like the Sopranos.
Right.
And get back into it, because they're not just closing the lights on a set and walking off and writing and going back and shooting it. They have to go all over the world with a cast of thousands, you know, and extras and outfits and all that kind of stuff. So I feel badly in a way for Dan and Dave, because even though I think Railroad has been vocal about saying he's with this and he, you know what I mean? Like, he gives it his full approval. He's working on the show. People shouldn't get upset. It's a great, you're going to love the story, but I'm still going to write the books. He has a very positive outlook on it. I feel like if something doesn't go right, they're going to get a lot of blame that is not deserved.
Well, Heath, I mean, how do you feel about all this that we've been talking about?
Well, I feel bad for book readers that read the source material way before the show. I don't empathize because I'm an ABR, but I can sympathize. But at the same time, it's a different medium. And, I mentioned when me and Axel were on the film list how I was like upset at book readers, because I'm like, just go with it. Come on. But then I was like, well, I don't mean our people. Our people are cool. I met other people that I don't know that complain a lot. I sympathize, but at the same time, it's exciting, because if you're just what, like you had mentioned, Matt, and Ken had also mentioned this, where the book is one thing and the TV show is another. Now, I understand diehard book readers that you want to see what you envisioned and what you've been reading, and you want to see it on screen. But with the whole fact that there's a couple books that haven't been written yet, what else are they going to do? Like Axel said, with Sopranos, stop the show for 2 years? You can't do that. So I just hope book readers decide to, you know what, I'm going to enjoy the show for the medium, for what they've been doing. This is an amazing show. I do feel bad about the spoiler part of book readers, but at the same time, those on other podcasts, maybe the smug book readers who are like, ooh, I know what's going to happen and you don't. but then they won't theorize if something new comes up that's not in the book. And I'm like, come on, just theorize. It's fun. But so I kind of, it's a mixed bag, but I feel for the book readers that have put the time in to read and to really follow the books and who have supported it. I do feel bad, but I'm with Axel, I guess, because I'm not a huge book reader in general, that I'm more of a film TV guy, that I'm okay with it. And I actually am looking forward to seeing what the books do and in the future and what the TV show does. But I do feel, I just hope the whole community, it doesn't, podcasts don't become, you know, of, oh, this should have happened and I'm mad at this. I'm hoping people just enjoy it and the community will still go on to be how it is. But, it's going to be interesting to see what people, how the response is. And I just hope it's not a battle of NBRs versus BRs. I'm an ABR, so I'm in both camps. But, I think it's going to be fine, but I am a little scared. I hate to see the diehard book reader fans not like the show and be anti-show. It's a tough one, but I'm just hoping that everyone, in a perfect world, I would love everyone to love everything that's on the TV show and in the books, but that's not going to happen. And I don't know. I'm just hoping, as long as Matt, Bubba, Mikey Hull, and Ken, and my book readers, friggin' Italian, as long as they're happy and are going with it, I'll be happy.
All right. And I think that's a great place to end our discussion on for today, guys. So once again, Heath, the film list, you and Axel are talking about some of this stuff and about a great number of things. What's the latest episode of the film list sound like? What are you guys talking about?
Me and Axel did the latest episode. We talked Oscars, but then we had to get in Game of Thrones talk. So we got some Game of Thrones talk, a little SNL 40 on there. So we get a little bit of everything. So check out the film list if you want to hear me and Axel discuss more. And of course, You can follow me on the Twitter at Heath Actor if you ever want to talk Game of Thrones or anything related to life in general. And I just want to say I really appreciate Matt being on, you having me on again. It's you just enrich my experience of Game of Thrones, and I appreciate it. And then to hear the lovely voice of Axel Foley just gets me excited in general.
Axel gets me excited as well, and I love the fact that I get to hear his voice whenever I'm putting my podcast together because he's saying things like news about the television series.
Three words.
Brothel mates of the week. Axel, again, you've been on the film list lately, and how can people talk to you? You will be actually hosting a few of our initial reactions on my behalf this year because, folks, I will be away touring a little bit, but how can people get a hold of you to talk about Game of Thrones, the TV variety, folks? He is not an ABR. He is an NBR. Make sure to make that distinction when you tweet to Axel. How can they contact you about this series, sir?
I am W. Axel Foley on Twitter. You know something? I wanted to do this, and I don't know if I ever suggested it to you, to tell me the names of all of the chapters and just read them out. So when you're doing, even though I haven't listened to the, you know, the recent ones you've been doing too much because it's spoilerific for me. So I would just like say their name before, and then you could just like put it in while you guys are talking. It'll just come up in the background.
Actually, I stole them all.
Too.
I stole them all from the audio commentaries. Is where I stole them from.
Oh, okay.
Or from the audio versions of the books. So we have Roy Dotrice saying names wrong, like Brienne.
Brienne. I would love to hear Axel though butcher the names. He'd be like Brienne.
Well, many of
Brienne.
Anyway, I've got them all produced for the book sections for this time, and I've already got them in like separate files where each one's like bumper for 23, bumper for 24. So I appreciate the effort. Next year, when we do Game of Thrones, you will be the first person I call, and those will all be right. Easier names like Arya, or how about Jon? You know, well, I'll insist that you do them in a British accent, though.
I can do it, man.
All right. Thanks again, guys, so much for joining me. Here's Axel Foley disembodying himself so that he can come on to the bumper here and tell you how to contact me. Thanks for listening to Game of Thrones Podcast Winterfell.
You've been listening to Podcast Winterfell. Find the podcast blog at podcastwinterfell.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter, twitter.com/winterfellpod. Contact the podcast either by email, podcastwinterfell@gmail.com, or by calling the listener line, 314-669-1840.